Please be seated. Welcome to the 10:30 session of the Second Court of Appeals. Clerk, please call the cases.
The court will now call the State of Texas versus Speedway Grapevine et al. May it please the court, Ms. Susan Bonin to argue for the appellant, Mr. Scott Stollett to argue for the appellant.
Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Susan Bonin, and I represent the state of Texas. There are three reasons why this case should be reversed and the state granted a new trial. First, the trial court erred in admitting the valuation opinions of Speedway's owner. Second, the trial court erred in admitting the damage opinions of Speedway's appraiser. And third, there was no evidence or insufficient evidence to support the jury's damage verdict of $4.4 million. First, going directly to the issue of the valuation opinions of Speedway's owner. Under the Justice case, the Texas Supreme Court has said that a property owner, when testifying as to value, must provide the factual basis for his opinion. Now, cases have held what that means. If a property owner is relying on sales of other property to support a valuation opinion, he must provide a factual basis for concluding that the other properties are similar and a factual basis for concluding that particular adjustments are appropriate given the differences. Here, there was no basis provided by Mr. High for concluding that his property was similar to the two sales. In fact, you can see in the record when he was directly asked by counsel for Speedway, why are those sales comparable? He referenced the nature of the businesses, that being car washes, instead of the properties themselves and providing specific details about the real property. There was also a long list of items that came out that he did not know about these properties. And in fact, his own appraiser testified that it was not possible to rely on the sale of improved properties to value Speedway's property because adjustments could not be made. Then there's the fact that the state's appraiser actually attempted to do a valuation of the property based on other improved sales, and his opinion was stricken based on a challenge for Speedway. And the reason, one of the reasons his opinion was stricken, was because he didn't have a factual basis to support adjustments for equipment values. Yet when Mr. High testified to his opinion of value and he mentioned these two other sales, he himself made no such adjustment for equipment values.
Ms. Bonin, the arguments you're making at right this morning, how do you differentiate the question of the allowing of the witness to testify as the owner?
Well,
from how effective or credible his testimony might be because of the deficiencies you're outlining. I'm saying, aren't you really talking about attacking the believability and credibility and the strength of the witness's testimony as opposed to whether the witness should be allowed to testify as the property owner?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, while we certainly do not believe that it was his testimony was believable or credible, the issue goes beyond that. The issue is reliance and relevance of the testimony. And the Texas Supreme Court addressed this in the Justice case and said that a property owner is going to be judged by the same standards applicable to other expert testimony. What Justice case recognizes that by virtue of being the property owner, that provides the qualifications to actually testify. I mean, normally an appraiser has to have licenses, has to show his experience, has to show, you know, exactly what study he did to become familiar with the property that is in dispute. But with a property owner, because it is the property owner, he meets that qualification test.
But the property owner in this case had experience.
Certainly, he had experience in the car wash business. But again, that goes to his qualifications. That in and of itself does not go to support for the actual evaluation opinions. If you look carefully at the justice opinion, there were several different property owners in that case that actually testified. And one of those property owners was actually the loan officer at a bank, somebody that loaned money to people for loans for real property. And he demonstrated his familiarity with his own property, and he demonstrated his familiarity with area market values, and said that his opinion of value was based on property sales around in the area. And the Texas Supreme Court said, no, that is not enough. So you can't just, you know, give lip service to one of these six factors that is listed in the justice opinion. You actually have to have some sort of factual basis to support the opinion. I mean, it certainly, you don't have to do the same thing that an appraiser would do, where an appraiser would be required to do a written report and have various licenses, but you have to meet some basic standards of reliability and relevance. And more importantly than Mr. High not explaining exactly how his property was similar to these other two sales, he did not provide any information about adjustments. It's undisputed. He provided, actually in his deposition, he said they hadn't done any adjustments. And then at trial, he said, well, I've done some, but he didn't explain them in any way, shape, or form. And the record does demonstrate that there were differences between the Speedway property and the two comparable sales. They were located in different cities. Mr. High volunteered the fact that they were made 6 and 9 months after the date of acquisition, and that the market had actually been rising. So that's an adjustment that would have had to been made, because those sales took place at a time when the market was different from the date of acquisition. There were size differences. There were differences in the improvements built on the property. And we know that some adjustments had to have been made to support his opinion, because these two sales were $4.9 million and $5.25 million, yet he testified that the value of his property was $5.4 million. Yet he gave, it is undisputed, he gave no explanation for his adjustments. And if you look at the Wood case, that's a case out of one of the Houston Court of Appeals where they've actually applied the justice case in the context of property owners testifying about comparable properties. And in that case, they were trying to get a comparable rental rate as opposed to a comparable sale, but it's certainly similar. In that case, the property owner relied on the rental rate of a building that she owned, but she didn't give a factual basis for showing why that building was similar to the property that was being valued, or to show what adjustments were made. And the Court of Appeals held that that opinion was conclusory and did not actually support the judgment in that case. Now, I think the property owner rule is out there for a good reason. It recognizes that in a lot of cases, the numbers don't justify going out and hiring an appraiser. Appraisers cost as much as lawyers do per hour, and there are some disputes when it makes sense that a property owner, if he can meet the basic relevance and reliability requirements, will come in and give an opinion of value. But certainly the rule was not contemplated that it could be used in the way it was used here, where you have two appraisers who did studied opinions, and one said, I believe, $2.8 million. One said $3.2 million for the value of the whole property. And then you have a property owner who comes in and says, it's $5.4 million, with no support other than saying, well, I'm aware of these two sales that occurred after the date of acquisition that no one else considered. But in addition to the trial court erring in admitting the opinions of Mr. High with regard to the value of the whole property, the trial court also erred in admitting Mr. McRoberts' damage opinions. He was the Speedway appraiser, and his opinions were inadmissible for two reasons. First, they included non-compensable impairment of access damages, And second, they were speculative because they assumed that the improvements would in fact be torn down. Mr. McRoberts admitted that in his appraisal, he actually had damages based on a couple of factors, the addition of a dedicated right turn lane and the removal of a median cut where you could make a direct left turn into the property. These damages are clearly based on circuity of travel, which is not compensable. In other words, it's just it takes longer to get to the property. Instead of being able to turn directly into it, you have to go down a block, make a U-turn, and come back to the property. When you're leaving, you can't go left, you have to go right. This is circuity to and from the property. Now, what happened when his opinion was challenged was he said, well, I'm not going to consider that, or I'm not going to testify to that. And the court, you know, said you can't talk about this right turn, and Speedway said, and he's not going to talk about the loss of the median cut. But the problem is his opinion damage value didn't change at all. And if you look carefully at how that opinion was built up, you can see that those non-compensable impairment of access damages still exist in his opinion, because what he said is in the after, he said the improvements need to be removed completely. But once you do that, all the damages that arguably might be compensable, they're resolved. The internal circulation issues, the fact that the property is non-conforming with respect to the building setback and how much landscaping there is in front of it, the throat depth of the driveway on the property. You remove the building, you're left with a vacant piece of land. Nonetheless, he still damaged the vacant land after the acquisition at $10 less per square foot, resulting in an additional $500,000 in damages. So that demonstrates that regardless of him saying, I'm not going to talk about these access issues, those factors were still a part of his opinion, so he was still giving testimony based on non-compensable impairment of access. And the Supreme Court has said if a judgment is based on both compensable and non-compensable damages, the court must grant a new trial. That's the Bristol case and the Santikos case, and that's the situation we had here. There was another problem with Mr. McRoberts' testimony, and that's the fact that his damage opinions were speculative and contrary to this court's holdings in the Little Elm case and the Morrell case, because they presumed that the improvements would in fact have to be turned down. His opinion just didn't talk about how uncertainty about the improvements might affect the market value, but his opinion actually assumed that that the property owner or somebody purchasing the property is going to come in and tear down those improvements because that they couldn't use it otherwise. That was speculative. It's contrary to this court's opinions in Little Elm and Morrell as to what sort of testimony, damage testimony, could be admitted.
As Bonner, the aspect of the testimony that came from Mr. McRoberts dealing with the loss of the highest and best use of the property. I don't hear you attacking that.
He did testify that the property's highest and best use was changed. But the problem with that is that the Texas Supreme Court has recognized that even if there is a change in highest and best use, if those damages are based on something that is non-compensable, then you cannot recover, regardless of how drastic the highest and best use change is.
And what the presentation was at trial was that Mr. Roberts' testimony was the basis for a determination that, in fact, there was a that the highest and best use of the property would no longer be applicable as a car wash because of the various aspects of the access to the property, including the loss of certain of the features of the car wash. I'm talking about the vacuum units and that kind. And so if his testimony is admissible at all as an expert, and if what he is concluding as a part of his expertise, is that the highest and best use will not be capable of being the actual use of the property after the taking.
And
that is something the Supreme Court does recognize as an expert, as evidence coming from the realm of an expert.
Right. And certainly, but the problem here is that part of his testimony would certainly improve damaging out all of the improvements, saying it's a car, it's not a car wash anymore, so all these car wash improvements come down.
Have to be demolished. That's what
right.
he testified to.
Right. But you're still left with a vacant piece of land, which could be used for anything, and he damages the vacant piece of land, too. And the sort of damages that you referred to that support his change in highest and best use, those don't exist anymore after you remove the improvements. So he's relying on these non-compensable items to include an additional $500,000 in damages to the land itself. I see that I'm out of time. Our third error is really somewhat connected to the first two, having to do with the insufficiency of the evidence because of the other errors. For all these reasons, we'd ask that you reverse the judgment of the trial court and give the state a new trial. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Scott Stolle, representing Appalee Speedway Grapevine. I'm here today with my co-counsel, Craig Albert, who tried the case, and also with the client representative, Mr. Skipper High. The state's attack on Mr. High's testimony is nothing short of an attack on the property owner rule. They want the property owner rule to be every property owner has to qualify as an expert and give testimony as if he were an expert. Otherwise, it's not relevant evidence. I think it's real important in looking at what the state wants to do to examine what complaints did they make in the trial court and what complaints did they bring forward to this court. The two complaints that they made in the trial court in their motion to exclude were insufficient data about the comparable sales and that Mr. High didn't make adjustments to those sales. So they brought those two forward. They've added two complaints about conclusory and speculative. So when you look at the four complaints they've brought forward, the common thread between all those points is he didn't give us enough factual basis to support his opinion. Well, that's the discussion in the Supreme Court's Justice case. And the Supreme Court said there that the property owner's burden to provide factual support for the opinion is, quote, not onerous. In other words, it's an easy burden. It is a light burden. Now, you might ask the question, why would that be? Why would the property owner's burden be a light one to provide a factual basis that's something different than what an expert might have to do? And the reason is this, I think, that the property owner rule has two presumptions in it. One is presumes that the property owner is familiar with his property, and number two, presumes that the property owner is familiar with the value of his property. So, based on those presumptions, it only takes a small amount of additional factual basis in order for that property owner's testimony to be qualified, to be sufficient. So, in other words, Mr. High's testimony sufficiently reinforced the presumption that he was familiar with the property and the value. Now, how did he do that? How did he provide that additional support? There are lots of ways, but I'll start with this, his experience in the business. He's been in the business 40 years. He owns and operates 8 car washes. He's bought and sold car washes. He's intimately familiar with this property because he bought it. He had it designed. He had it built. He's familiar. He told the jury about the sunk costs he had in the car wash. He knows what services are provided at this car wash versus others, and he knows what it takes to make this piece of property profitable as a car wash. So he was sufficiently familiar to express his opinion. He met the light burden required to provide the factual support. Now, on top of that, he showed his familiarity with the market for car washes. And here, I will talk later about the two comparable sales. I want to talk about the other car washes he testified about. He was examined extensively about the other car washes that the state's appraiser testified about. And in that extensive testimony, he demonstrated his familiarity with the market. I would dare say that Mr. High knows more about the value of car washes than any appraiser you could bring into a courtroom. I'll give you an example. I could give an opinion about the value of my house, but I couldn't possibly say I know more about house values than appraisers. But Mr. High is different. He can legitimately say, and I believe the jury understood this, he knows more about car wash values than any appraiser. So the presumptions exist under the property owner rule. They were reinforced here with the factual basis that informed his view of the value of his property. That in and of itself was sufficient. On top of that, he added the two comparable sales. So those, and it's important to remember here, nothing in the property owner rule says that a property owner has to rely on comparable sales. It's just not a requirement. So without the comparable sales, Mr. High's testimony was sufficient, but especially with those sales, they were reinforcement of his opinion. So the state's two complaints about his testimony about the comparable sales, those two complaints can be completely disregarded because he didn't even need the comparable sales in order to support his opinion, to be admissible, and for the jury to give it the weight they believed it deserved. Now, let's say we indulge the state and we drill down to what did he know about the comparable sales. Well, he knew a lot, and he gave that evidence. I would point the court to volume 4 of the record where this testimony came out, pages 28 to 30 and 51 to 55. He testified about the locations. He testified about the sales prices. He testified about the dates of the sales. He testified about the size of each piece of property, the size of the buildings on each piece of property, the services that were available at those pieces of property, at those car washes, the types of equipment that was there. The state wants to nitpick about details he, quote, didn't know. And one of the important things here is the state is nitpicking largely about what he didn't know at his deposition. At trial, he explained, since his deposition, I've come to understand additional information. And he gave some of that information at trial. Most of the things the state wants to nitpick him about are things the state that either unimportant or the state didn't even bother to ask him about in cross-examination. So in summary about this business on the comparable sales, the trial court has broad discretion in admitting comparable sales. The standard is that they're excludable only if reasonable people could come to only one conclusion, that is, the conclusion that they're not comparable. If reasonable people could come to a conclusion they are comparable, they're admissible. And I submit reasonable people could say these two car washes are certainly something the jury could consider as factors that informed Mr. High's opinion about the value of his property. It goes to the weight of the testimony and not the admissibility. So there was no abuse of discretion in allowing the testimony about the comparables, even though, as I said, those comparables weren't even necessary to support Mr. High's opinion. Now, the state also complains that Mr. Hyde didn't make adjustments to the comparables. That's what he said at his deposition. At trial, he was asked by the state's lawyer on cross-examination, do you know what adjustments appraisers make to properties? Are you familiar with that? He said, yes, I am. And he went on and elaborated that he, in fact, after his deposition, he made adjustments to the opinion he gave at his deposition. He applied some of those adjustments, and he came to a different number. So the number he gave the jury at trial for the property's pre-taking value was an adjusted number from the number he used in his deposition. So the fact of the matter is the only evidence...
What value was in his deposition?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What did he say the value was in his
deposition? He gave a range in his deposition of $5 to $6 million as the pre-taking.
5.4 trial?
Yes.
Okay.
So the state's point of error is completely wrong. Their point of error is he made no adjustments. There is undisputed evidence in the record he did make adjustments. So the state's point fails flatly right there. Even if the points that the state is making is liberally construed to be one that, well, he didn't demonstrate enough about those adjustments, I disagree with the state's point that they didn't have any obligation to cross-examine the witness about what adjustments he made. The state's own counsel said in pretrial that fighting with a witness regarding adjustments is something to do in front of the jury because it goes to the weight. And the cases say that cross-examination is one of the substantial safeguards to prevent misuse of comparable sales. The state didn't take advantage of that substantial safeguard. Didn't cross-examine Mr. High at all about what adjustments he made. Also, Rule of Evidence 705A says a witness doesn't have to disclose the underlying facts or data when giving the opinion, but can be required to give those on cross-examination. Again, the state didn't take advantage of that ability. The state says that it has no burden to show the reliability of Mr. High's adjustments. Well, that's not the question. That's not the point of error they brought forward. They didn't bring forward a point that his testimony was unreliable. They just said he didn't make any at all. And this court said in Crosstex versus Button, the court made the point that Crosstex does not tell us in what way the properties were so different from each other or the subject property that adjustments should have or could not be made. So this court has looked at that question and rejected the argument the state is making. I will also make a final point about the state's obligation to test the opinions. The property owner rule has a presumption, obviously, and we all know that presumptions typically work to shift a burden. So the state cannot say that they have absolutely no obligation to test the opinions. The opinion came in. It was obviously accepted by the jury as part of the factors that informed Mr. High's opinion. So there was no abuse of discretion in offering and allowing that evidence, and the jury could rely on it. Now, if the court were to adopt the state's view of the property owner rule would have little or no utility. Basically, the state is probably the largest acquirer of land every year in this state. So they would love to undermine the property owner rule. And basically, that's what they're asking this court to do. Make them all be experts. Well, that's a hyper-technical view of what the case law says on the property owner rule. It ignores what the Supreme Court said in Justice, that the burden is a not onerous or a light burden. The property owner rule was instituted to expand who could testify about property opinions. The state wants to make it a retraction. Remember, Texas has a long history of recognizing property rights, and the property owner rule is a significant and important part of that. And also, property owners testify under Rule 701, not under Rule 702 as experts. So the state's argument should be rejected. They would ask you to eviscerate the property owner rule. One last point I will make about the state's global theme, which is they're saying there's a windfall here, and I vehemently disagree. These were uniquely jury questions about value. The jury could accept that testimony. This was a valuable piece of property. It was near an important intersection, a busy intersection, a very good intersection for a car wash. The city behind this piece of property had a huge 180-acre master plan development in progress or in the planning stages. This was a valuable piece of property, and it was tightly engineered. If you cut off 20 feet of this property, you totally destroy what they were able to do in engineering this property for the traffic flow and for the length of the tunnel. And I'll just focus, for example, on the length of the car wash tunnel. Mr. High testified, we have to have every bit of equipment in there. We have to have that tunnel to make money on this property. And you can't slice off 20 feet of the tunnel. And you can't move it to the back of the property either, because you're boxed in by the property line and by an easement back there. So the state's taking destroyed the large part of the value of this property, as the jury found, and that finding should be affirmed. Thank you.
Council.
Yes, Your Honor. As I indicated, our third point of error is somewhat connected to the other two, and that is the problem that the jury's verdict is outside the range of testimony, so that there is no evidence to support the verdict. The only damages opinions that were in evidence were the opinion of Mr. Wall at approximately $100,000 in damage, and the opinion of Speedway's appraiser, Mr. McRoberts, at $2.6 million in damages. Yet the jury rendered a verdict of $4.4 million in damages. And that's why the state is suggesting that this is a windfall. Clearly, the verdict was outside the range of the testimony. And that result cannot be justified, one, by looking to Mr. High's opinion of the whole property for all of the reasons that we've already discussed, because his opinion of the whole was unreliable, it was irrelevant, and it was conclusory. However, even if you ignored that our objections to that testimony, there was no evidence introduced connecting up damages with an amount of $4.4 million. If you look at the Petropolis case, the Texas Supreme Court addressed this very type of situation where a landowner came in and introduced its own value of the whole and then said, we're going to rely on the state's value of the remainder, and there's about $300,000 in difference between those two numbers. Ultimately, they got a verdict for about $300,000 in damages, and the Supreme Court said no, that there's no evidence to support that amount of damages. I mean, you have to have some connection between the amount of damages and the number that the jury actually came to. And no witness testified to an amount of damages of $4.4 million. And for that reason, that's a third reason why this verdict should be reversed and the state should be granted a new trial. Going back briefly to respond to some of Speedway's comments during their time here, they say, well, Mr. High knows a lot about the value of car washes, and he probably does, but you got to remember, when the state acquires property, They're not acquiring car wash businesses. They're acquiring real property. And so when you're trying to give a valuation for purposes of a condemnation case, whether you're an appraiser or you're a property owner, you have to focus on the real property and you have to focus on what's compensable. Well, yes, he says this car wash is worth all this money, but he very well may be relying on the goodwill of the business. He may be relying on the non-compensable personal property that the state is not taking. And if you look back at his deposition, he indicates that it was his intent to try to recover damages for the circuity of travel, that he understood that the appraisers couldn't talk about that, but he really thought he was entitled to those sorts of damages. Mr. Wall, the state's appraiser, talked about the fact that goodwill and personal property are things that have to be pulled out when you're just trying to value the real property. So the fact that Mr. High has a lot of knowledge about car wash businesses himself doesn't mean that he can simply come in here and say, this is what I think the property is worth. We're not asking.
You said that he may have done this, he may have relied on that, and then you pointed to your expert. Did you challenge him on cross-examination about all that?
We challenged him by filing motions to exclude his testimony. I'm sorry?
Did you hear my question?
Yes, we did not.
Did you challenge Mr. High in front of the jury? I take it you didn't, because you're saying to us he may have relied on this, he may have relied on that, which tells me it's not in the record, which tells me he wasn't challenged, right?
It was not challenged in the way that, Speedway says, is arguing that we should have challenged it.
Right. The other question I had was, I listened to his explanation about adjustments and your statement that none were made. Which is right? You said none, and I just heard Mr. Stully say, wait a minute, the witness testified to.
He testified at deposition that he made none. At trial, he said, I've made some, but he did not explain what they were. And
did
it.
You ask him?
No, we did not ask him, but that is not the state's burden. They have the burden to show that the evidence is sufficient to support the verdict, which is a problem that they just haven't done that here. And you also have to take into account that we challenged this. There was a continuing burden that was brought forth by our pretrial challenge saying his opinions, they're not relevant, they're not reliable. The court denied that. We got a ruling on it. We preserved that. So he was under a continuing burden to come forward with evidence supporting his opinion. I mean, there's that, and then there's the fact, all the case law that says if your opinion is conclusory, then it's not sufficient to support a verdict. And the burden is not on the opposing party to try to parse out the opinion and make their case for them. For all of these reasons, we'd request that you grant the state a new trial. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your argument. Your case is submitted. And you are excused.